minutes of the meeting reflect merely that Eisner reviewed Mr. Ovitz's professional and educational credentials. Directors later testified that they did discuss Ovitz, albeit briefly. Neither Litvak nor Bollenbach, both board members, said anything about their refusal to report to Ovitz or their reservations about his hiring. No one asked what would happen if Ovitz didn't work out, or under what circumstances he could be fired, and neither Eisner nor Russell volunteered anything on the subject. No one raised any questions about the fact that Ovitz retained an ongoing economic interest in his former clients at CAA, since he still earned commissions on revenue received under agreements he'd negotiated while at the agency. Though Ovitz never concealed this arrangement from Eisner or anyone else, it posed an obvious potential conflict, since Ovitz had a financial interest in having Disney hire his former clients. The board unanimously approved the appointment of Ovitz as Disney's president. Moreover, it agreed that Irwin Russell should be given a $250,000 payment for his extraordinary services in negotiating Ovitz's contract and persuading him to come to Disney. As he had with Frank Wells, Eisner was happy to delegate to Ovitz tasks that he found distasteful. In one of their first meetings, Eisner went over with Ovitz a list of executives that he considered problems. Much to Ovitz's surprise, the list included Joe Roth and Bob Iger. Just as Ovitz had found Joe Roth to replace Katzenberg, Eisner wanted him to line up replacements. And Eisner wanted Ovitz to fire Dennis Hightower immediately, just months after naming him the head of the television division. Hightower seemed always to be traveling to European capitals for days at a time, to Houston for video conferences. Rumors circulated that he was still working for the CIA. But perhaps he was just trying to flee the unpleasant reality that he was completely out of his depth in television and had no one to guide him. In any event, Eisner had been hearing a stream of complaints. Hightower had become an embarrassment to him, and Eisner did his best to ignore him. "You've got to fire him," Eisner told Ovitz. "I'm not going to fire him," Ovitz retorted. "You hired him. You fire him." Eisner looked annoyed. "Then you've got to do something for him," Eisner said. During their walk in Aspen, Ovitz had made clear that he expected to at least maintain, if not enhance, the lifestyle he'd acquired while at CAA, which included the usual perquisites of a top-level Hollywood executive: personal assistants, access to a corporate jet, a car and driver when in New York, and a virtually unlimited entertainment budget. The same night the board approved his contract, Ovitz had hosted a party at his house for the prominent contemporary artist Chuck Close. To Ovitz, the party served numerous synergistic purposes, cementing his stature as a prominent art collector with stars like Tom Hanks and directors like Steven Spielberg, who might also want to do business with Disney. Such entertaining was a way of life for a high-profile agent, and it was second nature to Ovitz. Indeed, he felt one of the reasons Eisner had so few personal relationships with creative people in Hollywood was that he didn't do enough of that sort of thing. Chuck Close was used as a centerpiece for the party because Disney is in the creative business, and he is probably one of the four most important living artists in the world today, Ovitz explained.